programs and why they're important to us.
Sounds great. Is this thing on?
Okay.
Not knowing exactly what everybody would have an interest in discussing this afternoon and only having 30 minutes to do this, what I've done is sort of put a collage of various ideas together for you to think about and sort through. And I think the practicality of doing some of these things will probably come later in the program when the actual cattle feeders have an opportunity to discuss what's possible and what's not possible. So if you'll bear with me a little bit, we're just going to talk theory for a moment. I want to start out and talk about when we talk about verification programs, process verification systems, any of those auditable quality management sorts of systems, you can't do that without also discussing animal identification and traceability as a component of those systems. And so I thought I'd start out and talk a little bit about what would be the purpose of implementing one of these systems back on the ranch and what you might be targeting as a result of using the effort and the blood, sweat, and tears that's necessary to implement one of these systems. The first thing that is important about one of these systems, in my mind, probably the priority issue, is protecting the health of our population. And so, as you all know, NAIS is being implemented primarily with the objective of protecting animal health. The problem with NAIS is it's only going to go to the point of slaughter, and from that point on, we're not going to be able to take advantage of some of the other opportunities that manifest themselves when we have an animal traceability and identification system. If we were to go further, the other things that we can do are we can promote consumer confidence with the product, particularly in our export markets, but also here at home. And then thirdly, we can add value because as you pile on information onto traceable identification, then you can begin to use that information, mine it, if you will, to make stronger management decisions relative to all sorts of things, including genetics. I published a paper at the University of Massachusetts that we've liked this quite a bit because it sort of defined what you would want to evaluate in terms of an identification and traceability system. They sort of paraphrased it by classifying it into these three categories: depth, breadth, and precision. What we mean when we use the term depth here, then, is how far back or forward in the production chain does the traceability go? Okay? Breadth is the amount of information that's collected. So, for example, NAIS will essentially have three data points in it. It'll be a premises ID, it'll be a date, and it'll be a tag number. So, the breadth of NAIS will be significantly less than a system that is also adding information concerning management, feeding practices, veterinary practices, those sorts of things. And so the breadth has a big impact on the usefulness of the system. And then lastly, precision is the degree of assurance with which a tracing system can pinpoint a particular food product's movement. So, for example, if you're using NAIS as the example, we say that we want to be able to identify an animal health outbreak within 48 hours, trace that back to its source so that we can implement containment practices. So the precision of that system would essentially be to allow us to conduct the trace within 48 hours. So if you start talking about this depth, breadth, and precision thing, and I know that there's been an awful lot of discussion about this during the past 6 or 7 years, among industry, the current NAIS program is going to go to right here. It's going to stop at the plant. And so its sole purpose, its sole benefit, is going to be to trace back production and location for purposes of identifying source of animal health outbreaks. But we're not going to be able to use the information associated with that much beyond that point in the production chain. If we actually want to add the consumer confidence and management capabilities that the system might provide, we're going to have to take our traceability or our verification system all the way out here to the retail, to the consumer. A lot of folks have asked the question, who's going to pay for this? That's a standard question in our industry, and it has some merit. I mean, it's an important question to ask. One of the things that we think is going to help pay for the system, if we ever get something implemented, is the fact that this is something consumers have wanted. This was a will-pay study, or willingness-to-pay study, that was published by Dixon and Bailey a few years ago. What they did is, in a will-pay study, what they're asking people is not for their opinion. Would you consume more beef if this happened? That's not what they're asking them. What they're saying is, we're going to make you pay for this out of your own pocket. And so the data they gather is what the consumers actually were willing to pay for the product out of their pocket. When they conducted this study, you'll see they looked at traceability, animal welfare, food safety, and then the combination of all of those attributes. Traceability in and of itself wasn't a gigantic increase in value to those consumers. In other words, just the knowledge that we could trace an animal back didn't really provide them any meaningful, useful information at the consumption point. When we start combining that with adding information associated with welfare and food safety, when you add those all together on that all attributes column, then there's a substantial increased value to the consumer for that opportunity. They asked me to talk a little bit, Bob did, about the importance of these systems in the international markets, and so I'd like to do that now. I'm going to start out and indicate what the importance of the international markets are to us. I think as an industry, at the production level, we all have a better idea of how valuable exports were to us now that we've had BSE in the United States, because once we lost it, then the ramifications became much more clear to us. But if you look at where our true growth is, you know, in the United States, we're consuming something in the neighborhood of 65 pounds per capita beef consumption. You know, you have to ask yourself, if you're a producer, how much more can we expect consumers to purchase and consume each year? You know, what I'm getting at is the only real opportunity to grow our market in terms of volume or value is to come up with other avenues for marketing the product. And so when you start looking at world numbers, I mean, in the United States, we just passed the 300 million mark in terms of population. The rest of the world, we have almost 6.5 or 6.25 billion people. What that means is that if we truly want to grow the beef industry in terms of volume or value, then our greatest opportunity for growth is outside the boundaries of the United States. And in fact, over 94% of our consumers, our potential consumers, live outside the boundaries of the U.S. So relative to exports then, whether it's beef production, pork production, poultry production, we've had some pretty good success stories during about the past 15 years. Whenever we started signing the trade agreements, the NAFTA agreement, the WTO, those various trade agreements, they've had a big impact on improving our access to various export markets. And so you can see what happened starting in 1990 and moving through what they're projecting out to 2015. You'll notice the big dip right here in this slide. The green is the beef exports. That's where BSE hit and where we lost all of that market share globally. So relative to the importance of traceability and verification practices in the export markets, I decided to use a paper that was published on cattlenetwork.com where Phil Singh was interviewed, the CEO of U.S. Meat Export Federation. I thought he made some very good comments in this. Firstly, if you look, he said that, as we've already discussed, it became clear to us as an industry how valuable exports were to us after we lost them, after BSE in 2003. Next thing he said is that there's a growing trend among consumers globally. They're no longer willing to simply accept what they are told. In other words, whether you're a consumer in the United States or even more so if you're in Mexico or Japan or Korea, they don't really have a lot of confidence in what their government's telling them relative to the safety and the quality of products that they're purchasing. They don't trust them. And so as a result of that, they would like to have some credible information traveling with the product that allows them to evaluate the product characteristics themselves. So he says international consumers seem to desire verification of claims more than U.S. domestic consumers, although it's also growing in the United States. He says being able to verify certain attributes through auditing, traceability, and animal identification is becoming one of the hottest topics for global meat trade. And I can confirm for you that that is absolutely the case. He uses the EU as a perfect example of how this can benefit cattlemen in the United States if they take the initiative to implement a process verification system that is auditable and that can be confirmed. And it has to do with marketing in the European Union. You all remember back in the early 90s and late 80s, the European Union was heavily subsidized. So they produced more beef than they could consume because the government was essentially paying for it. Therefore, they kept us out of their market because we could produce beef more cheaply because ours wasn't necessarily as subsidized as much. And they had to figure out how to sell this over-tonnage that they'd produced themselves. They kept us out, and they tried to market the beef domestically. Well, over time, as the trade agreements kicked in, a lot of their overstock has went away. In fact, at this point, there's some estimates out there right now where they might need 1.1 million tons of beef imported into the European Union. They become a net protein deficit consumer market. That's really good news for us, we think, because that's going to open some doors for us to immediately capture or recapture some of the European market. But to do that, we're going to have process verification systems in place, because the only way they're going to allow product into their country, if it, any of their countries, is if it meets the EU standards, which includes things like animal identification and traceability to origin, country of origin labeling, all that stuff. And so that's an opportunity, but to capture it, we need to be thinking about trying to implement some of these systems. He talks about lucrative markets for beef like Japan and Korea after BSE, and I'll talk more about this in a second. When we finally were able to get those markets reopened, it was based on partially a system of being able to identify and follow cattle through the production system so that we could verify certain characteristics associated with their production, i.e. age in cattle going to Japan. Then he talked about not only did BSE remove from the U.S., remove us from many international markets, but it also created some significant competitors. And I know Canada's here, and I don't know if there's anybody here from Australia, but it's been a great benefit to the countries that haven't experienced BSE, like Australia, Brazil, some other countries, and capturing the market that we had to give up when we detected BSE. So he summarizes this, and he says there is value for producers participating in export programs, which should be capitalized on as quickly as possible before more market share is lost. Let's talk about this a little bit. I'm going to use Japan as my example, but this could be Korea, it could be a lot of other countries. I was over there a couple of years ago, and we specifically wanted to evaluate their traceability system, and so we met with lots of folks and looked at their system. These are some pictures from their largest retailer, Jusco, which is owned by Aeon Corporation. And this is one of their stores in Tokyo. And I know it's not showing up very good in here with the light, but if you look at their program, starting at calf, at birth, they put two tags, one in each ear, that are identical to each other. They're both barcoded with a unique identification number. That animal's followed then through the entire production system, till ultimately, when it gets to retail, you can see that there's a barcode on this retail label that's the identical barcode that was on their ear tag. And in fact, this is just a random package of meat that I happened to pull out of their case. And what I wanted to do is try out the system in the store. You go over and you scan that barcode into this little kiosk that they have sitting by the meat counter, and it'll print out a deal that looks like this with all this information. So this was an actual piece of meat that I pulled out of there. And we scanned it, and here's the actual printout. Now, there may be some folks in the room that this has meaning to, but I'm not one of them. I asked a good friend of mine in Tokyo to translate this for us, and this is what that output tells you. And I know it's difficult to read. I can't get it all on the slide. But what it tells you up here, I'll just work through it for you. It tells you every owner of that cattle, that piece of meat came from. It tells you where they're located, it tells you their address, and it tells you when they changed ownership. Down here it talks about who fed them, it talks about who slaughtered them. So it's essentially like our NAAS, except for it follows them all the way to the retail level. Over here, the second page of that printout tells you everything you ever wanted to know about the cattle from which that retail cut came from. It tells you what they were fed, how they were fed. It tells you whether they received any veterinary treatments. Even down here tells you that that carcass was tested for BSE, and so they think that that's how they ensure safety relative to BSE in Japan. So that's a ton of information that's available to every consumer on every package of meat at the retail level. Now, getting there is another matter, but that's what the expectation is for consumers in Japan. Here's Europe's system. You've all heard about the passport system in Europe. It starts out up here with a ticket that goes on a carcass. You can see the barcode using a standard, international standard barcode system. It tells you where the animal was slaughtered. It was born in Denmark. It was slaughtered in Belgium. It tells you the approval number, the animal identification, all that. As you move through processing, then here's fabrication. The first time that the cuts the carcass is divided into subprimals. Here it's divided into retail cuts. By the time you get down here to the label that goes on the retail package, you can look and see it tells you everything about that product, where it was produced, where it was handled. So this one was born in Denmark, slaughtered in Belgium. It was first cut in the Netherlands, and then it was cut into retail cuts in Spain and probably marketed in Spain as a retail cut. So something similar, albeit not quite the amount of information that the Japanese have in their system, but quite a bit of information relative to what consumers' expectations are. So going back to what Phil Singh was saying, let's talk first about competition. You're all aware of what's happening in Brazil and other countries. In fact, Brazil has just recently entered our market. If you look at Brazil, they have 314 million farmable acres, of which 151 million are currently farmed. So that means that leaves them, 160 million acres that they can still exploit for purposes of growing soybeans, growing corn, growing cattle, whatever. And because their labor is so cheap in Brazil, obviously they have to be a competitor that we have to address. Okay? So what Phil is saying is if we want to compete with a low-cost producer in somewhere like Brazil, what we have to do is differentiate our product and demonstrate to the consumers that are purchasing it, our products, why our product is more desirable to them relative to something that came from Brazil. So that's an important aspect of why we need to verify products. He also mentioned the fact that if we don't have access to a market, it doesn't matter what we do, we can't sell beef. We have to be able to get it into the country before we can sell it. What's happened since all of the trade agreements started being signed in the early 90s is that as time has went on, you can see that the tariffs that were preventing us from entering markets have declined, while at the same time, in an effort to offset the reduced tariffs, what countries have done is implemented what's called SPS rules. SPS stands for sanitary and phytosanitary rules. So what they're doing is now, instead of using tariffs to keep us out of their country, they're using technical regulations to keep us out of their country. And that's what we're clearly fighting in the current round of WTO negotiations that isn't making much progress. If you take that into consideration with the fact that, according to the World Health Organization, over 75% of the new diseases over the past 10 years that are being experienced around the globe by lots of people in lots of different countries, 75% are due to are zoonotic sort of diseases. They originate from animals. So the reason that we're seeing these technical barriers to trade is because of what they have justification for doing it down here. What are those barriers look like? If you look between 1995 and 2004, you can see that they generally increase over every year that we were trying to export products into those countries. If you break down the SPS violations by what they consist of, which technical regulation they're intending to address. Food safety and animal health and zoonotic diseases account for 67% of those technical barriers. So that's where we need to focus. How do we address those? The only way we're going to address them and access those markets is if we can document that in production we don't do things, we manage these problems that they have to be concerned out of the product. This is a list I put together last fall for a talk I gave, but this is basically at the point I gave this talk, there was a total of 87 technical barriers to trade associated with beef production in other countries. And so I just listed a few of those up here, and you can go through and look at those. Basically, though, if you look at the common denominator amongst all of those barriers to trade, the one thing that would allow the government, our government, to help access those markets more fully would be if we had some sort of traceability and verification system in place. And so, truly, when you get to the end of the day, access is another important component of trying to export. And it's highly associated with our ability to verify production practices and trace the product. You're all familiar with NIAS, so I've talked about it a little bit already. You know what the objectives of the system are. In the United States, what we've said is it's not going to be a mandatory system, it's going to be voluntary. And so we have sort of a time schedule we'd like to voluntarily implement this program in. We want to achieve these by 2009. It's basically technology neutral, so you have lots of options for which technologies to use in the traceability system. And there's the question then becomes is how long it's going to take us to implement. I mentioned this already, but if you look at what the system consists of, it tells you which animal was where at what time, and that's it. So there's basically three pieces of data that go into NIAS. The date, the animal, and where it was, or where it moved to. Okay? So the question is, by the way, their schedule is to achieve that by 100% by 2009. We just passed this hurdle, which was 2006. They expected to have 25% of premises registered, and they just made that, according to USDA. I think we're actually quite a ways from being able to use this in terms of our export. Secretary Johans did a talk about a year ago. He was talking about the NIAS program and where it's heading and what was being done. Of course, there's been some changes in their view since that point. But one of the things he talked about was how important traceability was as a trade issue. Now, there's no question that if we can implement NIAS, that it will assist our efforts to gain access into several markets as they pertain to trade barriers resulting from animal health issues, but only animal health issues. Because once the carcass goes by through the plant and on through the production system, then NAIS is not going to assist us in addressing any of the other issues that, for example, the consumers in Japan would be interested in having us address. So that's the one fallback to NAIS. We talked about the usefulness of it in preventing or containing animal health issues. I want to talk about this real briefly. If you look at what we've talked about generically as being biosecurity in the United States, there's actually a couple of things that I'd like to point out. It depends on who you're talking to as to what they mean when they use the term biosecurity. For example, the guys at Oklahoma State say that biosecurity is used to describe programs for preventing the introduction of pathogens considered potentially harmful to the health and well-being of the herd. So they're looking at it strictly from the cattleman's perspective, and they're saying, if we implement biosecurity, what we're doing is implementing procedures to prevent diseases from entering our herd. Fair enough? If you go to the National Research Council, what they say is it's the policies and measures taken to minimize the risk of introducing an infectious pathogen into the human, agricultural, animal, and research animal populations. A much broader definition, wouldn't you agree? Sunshine Project says that on a very practical level, there may be differences between means to prevent an unintended release into the environment and a means to prevent the abuse or theft of a specific organism. So they're starting to talk about things like homeland security issues in there as well. So these are very different definitions. What I would pose to you is that true biosecurity looks like something like this. It includes both biosecurity in the strict definition of the term, in other words, minimizing or preventing the importation of infectious pathogens into your herd, but also it's the prevention of disseminating pathogens out into the food chain or into the environment as a whole. And if you look at what's necessary to implement procedures that address both of those issues, there's really only one difference. It's where you purchase from relative to biosecurity, and it's where you sell to relative to biosafety. And so those are additional things that we'd have to control to address these issues. So let's talk about mad cow disease then for a moment. I think everybody in the room is probably intimately familiar with what happened on December 23rd, 2003. We all called it the cow that stole Christmas. Randy Block put some numbers together several years ago, right after it happened, trying to figure out what it was going to cost us to lose our export markets. What he said was that when you do all the math, you'll end up somewhere between $165 to $190 a head is what we lost immediately following BSE detection in the United States. If you look at where our exports went prior to BSE, that means that you could sum up about 56% of that $165 to $190 was due to losing specifically two markets, Korea and Japan. And so that's why the industry has placed so much emphasis on trying to recapture those markets, get back into those markets. I was part of the negotiating team that did the agreement with Japan. A lot of people have been critical of the ultimate agreement, with fair reason. But let me tell you what happened in reality. When we got over there to negotiate with the Japanese government what was going to happen to restore trade, the United States went over there and said, "You're going to take our beef and you're going to like it." We didn't offer them a thing. Well, Japan had just been through severe scandals in their government that they had to deal with, and there's no way that politically the consumers of Japan were going to accept the Japanese government saying, "Fine, we know your beef's safe, go ahead and keep shipping it just the way you were." We had to offer them something, and there was nothing to offer. So what ultimately ended up happening was development of the beef export verification program. What that was a standard under which we could export beef to Japan with some constraints on what they would accept into the country and what they would not accept. The key piece of that was this: that bovine animals included in the BEV program must be traceable to live animal production records, which indicate that they are 20 months of age or younger. Now, I don't agree technically with why the Japanese wanted them to be less than 20 months of age. We all know the problems associated with that. But nonetheless, to get back into the market, to get our foot into the door, this is what was required. To date, how many of you are familiar with the BEV program and what has transpired since? Today, and there was a big announcement this morning that our exports have increased this year already into Japan, one of the problems that we're facing as an industry is that we can't produce enough cattle that fit this BEV program. The bulk of the cattle from which cuts are being exported to Japan at this point are actually cattle that were certified as being A40 physiological maturity or less. Very few are being shipped that fell into this program. And that's hurting us as an industry because we can't get enough volume into Japan to satisfy the market. I don't know what it's doing.
Start over?
Sorry. So if you look at what we ended up agreeing on is ultimately we could generate data through a study that was conducted jointly with USDA. We could show them that cattle that were less than A40 physiological maturity 99.99999% of the time we're going to be less than 20 months of age, which was their requirement. Today, those are really 90% of what we're exporting to Japan today is falling into this category. It's not falling into that category that allowed us to track cattle and improve the volume. Our estimates at the time were that if we could use both systems, the A40 system and the traceability system with information, that we could probably generate or probably utilize about 30 to 35% of the population in Japan. That's not been the case. And as you all know, we're probably maybe at 5% level qualifying for A40, and so it's been a problem. The agency responsible for implementing the BEV program is the Agricultural Marketing Service of USDA. And the way that they do that is you have to develop a written set of procedures on how you're going to conform to the standards of the BEV, and then they come in and audit you. And the way that they audit you is they use an internationally recognized auditing standard for determining whether you comply with the BEV or not. So approval looks something like this. First, a company, and this could be a cattle feeder, it could be a cow-calf producer, it could be a packing plant, they submit an application to AMS, say, we would like you to review our program and qualify us under what's called a QSA program. They'd send an auditor in, and the auditor would go through all of the documents that you generate. Okay, we have these procedures that are written down on how we're going to ensure that our cattle conform to the requirements of the BEV program. Fair enough? Then they come back. Once they say that that's acceptable, then they come back and they go into the plants or the feedlots or back to the ranches, and they say, we've already evaluated your program. We know how it's supposed to work. Now what we want to know is whether you've actually implemented that program and whether it actually is working. And so that's the point of the on-site audit. And so after all that takes place, assuming you pass both the on-site and the desk audit, then eventually you're approved by them for export. What that means is that they put you on their website as being approved, and then the Food Safety Inspection Service will allow you to export to Japan. There's one other hurdle, though. What the Japanese government has said is that they also have to audit our plants to determine whether our plants are conforming to the BEV. And lo and behold, as all of you know, we've had several hiccups in that regard. Because sometimes the Japanese would say we're not conforming to the standard, while AMS will have said that we were, and so they shut down exports or they ship a load back or whatever. And so it's caused us a great deal of consternation. Ideally, if we had a large proportion of the population that was qualified in this sort of a program, it would improve the value of beef cattle dramatically because it would increase the tonnage that's eligible to export to Japan significantly. So that's what the BEV, the final BEV, looked like. And I just want to put this slide up here to make sure that everybody's clear on what the BEV is. The BEV is the standard under which you must produce cattle to export to Japan, or it could be Korea, or it could be the EU. The mechanism for conforming to this standard is to implement a quality system assessment program. So in other words, a QSA program that involves the procedures and the on-site audit that we just discussed. Ultimately, if we're going to export something, remember NAIS stops at the packing plant, right? So that's going to be unacceptable to Japan because it stops. So what has to happen is the packing plant has to start at the point where boxes are shipped to Japan and being able to prove that they qualify under the BEV program. And to do that, they have to have suppliers that conform to the BEV, and those suppliers have to have cow-calf producers back here that also conform. So it's a difficult chain of events that has to occur, and that's probably the reason that we don't have very many cattle qualifying for export under that program. Different ways you can keep records associated with conformity. You can keep them just handwritten, the old Big Chief notebook and pen sort of concept. There's also electronic mechanisms for keeping track of the records that are necessary to conform with the BEV. Also, I have one more caveat to this discussion about traceability and then, more importantly, verification of production practices, and that is how precise is the identification system going to be that you intend to use in your QSA program. Just this morning, there was an announcement that two plant managers in Northern Ireland were sent to jail for 30 years because they were found to have falsified documentation associated with the export in the EU of beef products. One of the problems becomes once there is value associated with a program, then that on the counter side of the issue creates the opportunity for cheating. We all know this, right? Once you increase the value by producing value-added cattle in a BEV program, you're also increasing incentive to cheat to also capture that BEV program's market. And so one of the things we've had extensive discussions about as an industry is should we be using something to identify and trace animals that would hold water in a court of law should it get to that point. And one of the only mechanisms that you could actually do that would have that kind of merit would be to use a biometric system. I've shown you the retinal scanning system up here, but that could be DNA or any other biometrical approach to tracing. I realize the cost of those technologies is excessive. So the question becomes is, do the costs, are they offset by the gains associated with that $150 to $200 per head improved export capability? Last thing I'm going to talk about briefly is you asked me to talk, Bob, a little bit about the domestic market. I think we've made tremendous strides as an industry in beginning to differentiate our products to improve demand for them over the past 10 or 15 years. Tremendous strides. If you look today, there's just a ton of different branded beef programs that all have some differentiating characteristics associated with them to help market the product. It's very important, and I believe it's had a big impact on our improved consumer demand during the past 10 years. In fact, if you look at the results of the 2005 National Beef Quality Audit, you'll see in our data that the average packer today sorts carcasses into 5.3 branded beef programs, and that has changed from 1995 to 2005. They had about 1 1/3 programs per plant in 1995. Today it's about 5 1/4 programs per plant. That's a significant increase in the number of products going into branded programs. What's one of the opportunities then to capture or distinguish your product out in the marketplace? It's to tell the story about your product. For the consumer to believe that story, you have to have put in place some sort of verification program that will allow them, provide them confidence that the story that you're telling them is in fact true. My last slide. There's lots of examples of how this has worked effectively within the industry. I've just pulled one that I have a slide for. It's the Harris Ranch Partnership for Quality Program. I wanted to show you these data. They started the partnership in 1998. What that meant is that all the producers that were participating in this alliance program were using genetics that were collectively determined to be useful for the program. I think you've seen this, Craig, right? If you look at what happened as the producers in that program began to use those genetics, they started out at 10% of them in 1998. By 2004, 78% of their producers were using those genetics. Look what happened to their costs in the feedlot relative to veterinary costs. Look what happened to their percentage of prime and choice carcasses as they moved through. This is their data. Look what happened to the premium that was paid for those cattle as they incorporated more and more genetics into that partnership program. And ultimately, the most important feature is look what happened to the average value of their cattle at the point where they were using a high percentage of genetics that were compliant with that alliance program. You see, the average cattle, if you retained ownership, was worth $54.40 more head by 2004 compared to 1998 as a base. That's their numbers, that's not mine. That's a legitimate increase in value that can be transferred back to the production level of the industry by conforming with their program. What does their program require? It requires that you document the management practices that you use, the genetics that you use, all of the components of going from 38% prime and choice to 74% prime and choice. Bob, with that, I think I've used more than my allotted time, and I'll stop. I guess if anybody has any quick questions, we could take them, but I think it'd be better if you got to hear from the rest of these guys who know a lot more about the real world than I do.
Somebody's got a question for Keith? You can shout it out. We'll just see you fired up here.
I just have more of a comment than a question. Keith does a great summary. Made the comment today that source verification is a difficult chain of events to cause to occur in the industry. And I guess I take a little exception to that. It's actually very easy to do. Everybody in this industry has gotten used to when they ship cattle, they have to have health papers. If you live from here west, when you ship cattle, you have to have rain papers. And you have to do it. Agent source verification is grand stuff, but very easy. Now, it just doesn't take much to get it done. So more producers can do it. It's not very hard to do it all. This morning we have the largest cattle feeder in the world. Now some of the most aggressive producers in this country don't worry about it. But we didn't need to worry about agent source verification because the rules are going to change and everything's going to be okey-dokey. So part of the problem we're having as an industry is not getting enough cattle that are documented to be exported to Japan is all these fake statements. And I think when the largest cattle feeder in the world tells the most progressive producers in this country not to worry about it, doesn't help.
And I have a big problem with that because we may, in fact, it is likely that we're going to get Japan to change from 20-month, for example, to the 30-month, like our domestic rules. But that doesn't solve their consumers' problem. I just showed you what their consumers' expectation is for product when it gets to the retail level. And so just because we get the requirements for export change, yeah, we'll probably be able to qualify more cattle under new regulations, but nonetheless, we're not going to have a lot of demand for the product when it gets to retail because it's not going to meet those consumer expectations. So it goes beyond just what the regulatory requirements are. I agree with you 100%.
So, Keith, just one question, Bob. I know you spent a lot of time in Japan, so let me ask you this theoretical question. You kind of already answered it. So if we change the rules to 30 months, so let's say that happens. Japan caves into that. It may take 2 years, but let's say they do that. What percent of the retailers or the customers over there do you think Keith are still going to want 20 months or under guarantee? Is it a high percent, more than half?
I don't have a lot to go on other than their history and their culture, and I'll tell you that they still test 100% of their domestic cattle for BSE. And so I don't anticipate their expectations changing, at least quickly. And as Phil has often said, and I know you've heard this, Daryl, we're looking at least 10 years down the road before we can recapture the market share that we had, if we ever are able to, that we had before BSE, and it's going to go a lot towards addressing that very question. I mean, we've got to address their consumer expectations, not necessarily their regulatory requirements. I don't know if that's answering the question.
Yeah, that's the best answer we have now, and appreciate it.
We'll take one more.
The documentation you were showing on the Japanese cattle, is that just certain chains, or is that most of them?
All of the retail stores I've been into have some system like that. I didn't talk about it, but the other picture up there was a system where they put up the phone numbers and you all have your cell phones and you get to the store and you want to know what the history was of a particular piece of meat. You dial it into your cell phone and it gives it to you right on your cell phone. So there's lots of mechanisms, but most of the retail stores I've been in, and I want to make a point here. This is not just beef and it's not just meat that they're interested in traceability on. If you go to one of those stores, everything in the store is traceable. I'm talking down to the lemon that you buy out of the bulk lemon bin. So that's the expectation, and I don't think we should overlook it as an industry.
Let's give Keith a nice round of applause.
Thank you.